Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast. My name is Scroobius Pip and this is episode 127. Thank you for tuning in, guys. We've got a Lauren Laverne on at last. This is one that I've been teasing for a long, long time, and I was delighted to finally sit down with Lauren. I'm stocking up on episodes at the moment because it's hard to get people in December. So I'll give you a heads up of what we got coming. Next week, I've got Robert Sheehan from everything, from Misfits and Killing Bono and numerous other things, talking about his new film, Jet Trash, and all sorts of other stuff. Some stuff that we weren't sure if we were meant to talk about because we're too early, but we did anyway. And then after that, I've got Michaela Cole, who was fantastic in Chewing Gum. She wrote, did everything, wrote, starred, and won awards in Chewing Gum. She's also in Aliens and in Black Mirror. So yeah, that's great. And then after that, it will be some drunk casts to end the year. Speaking of which, this Friday at SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com, which is one of the sponsors of the podcast, this Friday, hopefully, I'm trying to get them up for this Friday. It might be next week, but in theory, this Friday, if not sooner, we have Drunk Cast merch at SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com. Let me explain. For those who don't listen, the Drunk Casts are some of the most popular episodes. It's me, my mate Chris, and my mate Stu. And what we decided to do was have a T-shirt that's got the Drunk Cast logo on the pocket, on the breast as such. There's not actually a pocket. And then a back print for each of us. So there's three different designs. There's the Pip No Time to Explain a design. There's the Stew Whiffin design, which is a logo for the Whiffin, which is where we drink and record the Drunk Casts. And then there's Chris's Craig's Dojo design. So check them out. We're going to have them obviously available individually. We're going to do a bundle as well. To get all three, if you so desire. They're all designed by the amazing Claire Hoop. She's absolutely smashed it. Check out her Instagram. She's awesome. So, yeah, that's all available at SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com. But equally, we've just topped up on jackets and jumpers and woolly bobble hats. We've got everything at SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com. So head over there for all your Christmas needs. There's also my two discs. DVD of my Edinburgh Fringe show and my book, for God's sake, both of my books. All of these are great Christmas presents and stocking fillers, so get in there. On with this episode. It's with Lauren Laverne, who I absolutely adore, and I want to tell a quick story before we get going. Sorry, I've got a stutter. Before we get going, of the first time I met Lauren, me and Dan were doing her radio show, and it was a live thing, I think from the Roundhouse in the cafe bar bit there, and we had an interview and that, and when it finished I was incredibly unprofessional. I asked her to record a video, a message for my mate Stu's birthday, not Stu Whiffin, my other mate Stu's birthday, because Stu growing up, or when we were growing up, was the biggest Kinnicky fan in the world and loved Lauren. So I was incredibly unprofessional as an artist. I said, look, can you do this, a little video for my mate's birthday? And she did it, and she did the most amazing video. She kind of stood there and said, look, I understand, you know, obviously I'm married, but I understand if things had gone different in life, we could have been together, and I want to wish you a happy birthday. And it was absolutely amazing, and I love her for that, and it was delightful to actually finally get around to sitting down and talking. I'm a big fan of everything she's done over the years, so enjoy this episode. I'll be back at the end with a bit more information, and we'll go from there. All right, this is episode 127 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Lauren Laverne. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. We can get...
get going. I'm joined by Lauren Laverne. How are you?
Hi, Scroob. I'm good, thank you.
We've been organising this for ages, haven't we?
It's been, this is a bit of a dream, really.
It pleases me that it's taken this long, because it means that we both kind of really wanted it to happen. It means we're both busy, which is good, because that's good to have a flourishing schedule. But it also means we both genuinely wanted to do it, because there was numerous points where we could have just, I'll forget it. We keep trying.
Do you know what? I really, really want to do this. I'm so pleased to be here today. And even though it was a bit of a dance, I know that it's worth it.
We've got there. I'm delighted. And you were saying that we're in Old Street, which is your old ends.
So my old neighbourhood, yeah. It's the proper kind of Grandpa Simpson thing to say, isn't it? Once you've been in London a while, but I lived here. We are just off Silicon Roundabout, and that is where I lived. I lived at number 113 Old Street when I was 21.
Oh, wow.
Next door to what was then a burned out church, but is now the gentrified home of the London Symphony Orchestra.
Yes, of
and
course
above
it is.
A cafe, which is still a reasonably grotty cafe that does a good breakfast, which, you know, it's a good thing that some things stay the same. And that was my house. Yeah, we had a bar in the, it was three floors and cheap, which just sounds crazy. Like, younger people, when you tell them this, are just shocked. But, three floors and cheap. We had a bar in the front room that I'd brought down from Sunderland that I bought in Help the Aged for £20.
Amazing.
Orange velour bar.
It's really interesting with East London and things like that. And obviously everyone goes on about gentrification and stuff like that, and it can be all blown out of proportion. But they are areas that, I mean, the reason they become cool is because they're originally cheap and people could move there and artists could move there.
Yeah,
but
of course.
It's a strange mix, because I remember about 8-9 years ago now, I had some friends who lived here, and on the walk home one night, it was two girls, and they got beaten up, and it was horrible. Oh. And one of them got a really injured eye. But the fact was, I mean, I talked about it, and in no way just find it, but also saying, well, in rougher areas at certain times of night, do you know what I mean? You have to be careful or not go in certain places. It's weird how these areas become these cool artisty places, and you forget that as well as artists moving there, there's a lot of people who've grown up in rough situations.
It's complicated, isn't it?
It's a really weird mix.
I remember talking to a friend of mine about the West End, and we were talking about kind of the way that London changes and gentrification and stuff, and he said to me, well, you know, if you were to walk down Tottenham Court Road 100 years ago, you know, someone would have probably, you know, bushed you on the head and stolen your pocket watch. And I think the part of, you know, that places becoming kind of less dangerous, and it's one of the upsides, and you don't hear often the upsides of gentrification.
No, it's a really positive thing.
You know, perhaps you've got somewhere that, you know, it's worked better late, there's more people around, maybe there's an element that areas become safer, but obviously, you know, there's plenty of downsides to it as well. I think round here has changed so much, but it still has a lot of the spirit of, when I was here, when I was 21, there was like it sounds mad to say it, but there was nothing to do at the weekend.
Yeah.
Like, one of the games that we used to play, because we were still essentially children because we were so little, at the weekend, we would go out, and the best place that was open was the 333.
Yep.
Which is obviously, you know, been here forever.
Yeah.
And we kind of maybe go to like reggae night, which I think used to be on a Sunday at the 333. But the rest of the weekend, there was no shops open. There was nothing to do. We used to walk around and pretend that there'd been a nuclear attack,
it's
and that we were the only survivors. That was our best game.
It's just on the outskirts of the financial district of Fenchurch Street. And it's weird because growing up in Essex, Fenchurch Street is the station you come into. And coming at the weekends, you do suddenly go, oh, This is London. There's no one about. And you can see how, I swear, when 28 Days Later came out, I was like, did they book parts of London or just film it on a Saturday and Sunday when it was just...
Do you want to know the story? So I interviewed Danny Boyle, and he told me about this. So the trick that they used to get those totally dead sequences, because they didn't have any money when they were starting out that film, they had, I think it was the Mall, isn't it, at the beginning, that's kind of roped off, and they had some very pretty girls who happened to work on the team, and they asked the girls to stop the traffic.
Brilliant.
And talk to the drivers, because it was delivery drivers at that time.
Brilliant.
And they just kind of more or less like had to charm them.
Amazing.
And they found that when, you know, I think a few different people had done it, but apparently the girls got the best sort of strike rate at getting people to stop.
Yeah.
And they just said, look, we're doing this film, will you kind of hang back for a bit? So it's just literally charm.
In so many of them situations, politeness and friendliness is far better than having a bit of paper that says,
catch more flies,
we've got this,
with honey than with salt or whatever it is.
I mean, it's funny we mentioned that, because I was listening a while back to your your visit on Richard Herring's podcast. And obviously, I don't want to go over the same stuff. I recommend that people listen to that because it's a great episode. But you were one of the original Shaun of the Dead zombies that in the kind of in the pilot version that got the film made as such.
Yeah, I was actually the first zombie of any of the zombies. So what it was, it's on the DVD extras. So if anybody has that at home, they can check it out. But when they were trying to get funding for the film, Edgar and Simon and Nick just asked some of their friends, and I was one of their mates, to come and get made up as zombies. And then we would kind of like zomb around and just sort of help them make a taster tape. And then they, you know, took it to studios and kind of said, look, this is what it would look like. Yeah. Can you give us some money when they were trying to get funding together? And eventually it worked. But I can tell you, I was the worst actress on that set. I just couldn't keep a straight face. But because I was so pale and so thin.
It must be tough when it's your mates as well, anyway.
They're
deadly serious about it. But you're messing about as a zombie with your mates.
Oh, man, they were already brilliant. And everybody else doing it was a prop actor. But I think I kind of... The benefit I had was, I was just going to say, I was so pale and so thin in those days that I actually didn't need much makeup. They were just like... white contacts, she's good to go. And that was probably why I was first. Bosh.
Amazing,
done.
Amazing. So was Old Street, when you first moved down to London, was that your first kind of introduction to the big scary world of London?
It was sort of my first one. And this is I lived around here when this was my first flat that was mine. And we had one before that we somehow persuaded our record company to rent for us, which was, amazing. You know, again, the 90s. Oh, the hubris, the things that you could do in those days. So we persuaded our record company to hire us a flat because they needed us here and we didn't have anywhere to stay, which was in Camden, just off St. Paul's Road.
Of course the record company was renting a band a flat in Camden. Where else would you put them?
Yeah, exactly. Could it be more 90s? Yeah, exactly. We need some kind of strike up the Rembrandts. It's like an indie episode of Friends. We all lived there, and that was a really good laugh. And then a few of us moved to a flat here. So I've lived all over. I've lived all over London. It's generally been north, but I have kind of, been over to West London.
Yeah.
It's funny because I was thinking about, I talked to someone about this the other day. Like, I just arrived in London, and then I feel like everything really significant that's happened in my life since has happened within about a 3 mile square radius. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I haven't gone beyond that.
It's crazy. Well, let's kind of talk about that movement, I guess, because you started, I mean, as far as I can imagine, I don't know how many jobs people generally have as a very young child, but you've kind of only known the entertainment industry, right? Because you were very young when you started Kinnicky.
Well, I was 15, yeah.
15, exactly. You can't have had many jobs before that. I know you're from the Northeast, but still, they can't have been putting you to work that early.
No, do you know what? And it's funny because none of it was really supposed to happen. Like I always had a very clear plan about what I wanted to do. I thought I would, assumed I would go on to university and become an academic like my dad.
Yeah.
That was always what I wanted to do. And it's like the only thing I haven't done. I've had so many kind of different weird jobs and situations, but never that. And so, yeah, I started the band when I was 15. We started making records, and that was really supposed to be a reward. I mean, my mum always says that, I went to a very strict school and they pushed us very, very hard. It was a convent school, and it was quite, you know, hard as those in the kind of, you know, teenage sense of what's hard.
Yeah, sure.
And so as a reward, my mum would always, you know, let us go to gigs and kind of let us enjoy music and, you know, rehearse in the house and all that kind of stuff, get really, really into and go out, you know, so it was that kind of, I was nightclubs and, you know, my dad would come and pick us up at whatever time
that's
of night. Wicked.
That's great as a motivation and reward for going, you know, for knuckling down.
But here's the thing, it was supposed to be a distraction. So it's quite funny. Yeah. And she always says it's just so funny that that's ended up being, and it seems obvious when you look back.
Yeah.
You know, of course, like if you, you know, you just allow someone to do that and they start going to the Riverside when they're 14 or whatever to see all these different bands playing, just, you know, feed their head with all this stuff, that then that's going to become their life. And it has become my life. But that was never the plan, I think, for either of us. You know, I assumed that I would go to university and go down a different path, and sort of haven't. So, yeah, you know, I haven't done any of the things that I was expecting to.
Yeah.
But for a long time, I was...
do loads of good stuff though, right?
I mean, amazing. No, and I'm so happy and so lucky. But this isn't it's not a job I would ever have thought to aim for.
No, you know? I mean, again, that's what, two things there. Were your parents religious at all? You said you went to a convent school, and I went to an all-boys Catholic school, but my right. parents weren't religious. It was just in working class areas, they tend to be the better schools. So it's kind of you, not you fake it, but you kind of go, well, let's see that option.
Well, one's Catholic. My mum's Catholic. She's from a big working class Catholic yeah. family. And my dad is technically agnostic, but yeah, his religion is blues, I think.
Yeah.
So they're very kind of, my brother calls it, refers to our house when we were little as the culture TARDIS, yeah. right? So I just think it's a bit of a cheat, you know, people go, oh, you know loads about music. And, you know, I just grew up with all that yeah. stuff. So we had That's a very great. Kind of liberal, culturally rich little house yeah. in this little bubble. And so, yeah, my mum is Catholic. And so that was kind of part of yeah. our upbringing. But it wasn't that. I think sometimes when you say Catholic, you think kind of strict, prohibitive,
yeah.
bossy.
Yeah,
it wasn't any of that. It was kind of like very nurturing. And yeah, my school is, you know, a really fantastic yeah. school. Academically, certainly, you know, I spell really, really well.
Fantastic. You've learned the,
yeah, exactly.
and learned the right things. That's good, because it sounds as if you would have had a lot of support choosing the career you went down as well. Because, again, we're both kind of from areas in Essex and in the northeast in general that traditional working class areas, but in recent years have had Geordie Shore and The Only Way Is Essex that kind of paint an image of a striving for glamour and whatnot that it's true of part of those areas, but it wasn't anything I knew growing up.
It's funny that, isn't it? Because I always think that people misread that stuff. I mean, you know, obviously there's that culture exists, and that's
exactly.
part of the kind of mix, the cultural yeah. mix up there. I don't know if you saw Grayson Perry's series that he did where he went to the Northeast. He's done a few documentaries
yeah,
there now. And I think you would really connect
yeah.
with it. Because for me, there's a lot about that kind of stuff that people misread, right?
Yeah.
So for me, when I look at people dressing up in the really kind of maximalist,
yeah.
You know, makeup and all the eyebrows and the hair extensions and everything, I love that. You know,
yeah.
it's not something that I kind of did, but I can relate to it because I think I'm coming at that from a different place. And people often say about northerners or the north, like people who aren't northerners or don't know, oh, you know, well, good northerners, they've got your feet on the ground. And I think it's funny because for me, the culture that I grew up with is absolute opposite.
Yeah.
You know, it's about, and I don't know if this is the same for you, but it's about like a fantasy life. It's about this very rich kind of, the weekend is a place that you can kind of escape to and you
yeah,
live
completely.
Out your fantasy version of yourself, whatever that is.
Yeah.
So if that is, you know, looking like, you know, a Kardashian and kind of
yeah.
going to a club and wearing a little bandage dress, then you do that. You know, you get out there and you kind of, you go for that. And then for me, I had a kind of different version of that, you know,
yeah.
and it was about like DIY music scene and going to gigs. But we used to do stuff like, we'd do a gig, I remember once, taping ourselves in bin bags all over our outfits that we'd do a song and then we'd like rip the bin bags off. And then we had our
amazing
charity shop outfits on underneath. And
yeah.
obviously it probably looked like really terrible, but in our heads,
yeah.
it meant something. And I think the place that comes from, and I, you know, for me, I am like the daughter of a sociologist. So I would see the kind of structural, the structuralist analysis of things. And I think that is, say my grander who was a miner, his equivalent of that was that he was underground working night shifts for, you know, during the week. And then the weekend he would go to the working men's club with his brothers. He was one of 13.
Wow.
And they all used to sing and they sang together. They sang
Amazing.
Nat King Cole covers, you know,
they
were so handsome, you know,
yeah.
they were cool. And that was their real life.
Yeah.
That bit, you know, was the fantasy life, was the stuff that mattered. So when people kind of are really sniffy about shows like Essex or Geordie Shore,
yeah.
and I'm not saying, you know, I don't particularly watch either myself, actually, but when people are kind of derisory about them just as a reflex, you know, response, it really annoys me because actually that comes from somewhere that's really valid and interesting
Completely.
And that is as culturally rich as any other kind of, you know, cultural expression or
Yeah, and it makes me think of it's always kind of annoying me when people say a cinema is an escape from reality. It's an enrichment of reality. And it's a similar thing there of your weekends. It's not it's not escaping the hard work of the week. It's adding to it and enriching it and making it easier to get through that,
and
that hard work
that
area.
To you. It's where you kind of put your soul. And I remember I was in Newcastle last year doing the Six Music Festival. We came from Newcastle Gated.
Yeah.
And they asked me to do a Q&A with Brian Ferry there, which was so great. And I've met him a few times. And my dad was in a band with some of the members of Roxy Music.
Amazing.
So like over the years, you know, like he knew that. And my dad gives a list of people to find out about, you know, how what had happened to this guy and this girl, and which was really nice.
That's awesome. A few insider questions.
I only remember them all. Was like, she's the prettiest girl in art school. but anyway, one of the things that we were talking about was that, and actually, if you see it with Roxy and with Brian Ferry, this kind of very slick, like, you know, lounge suit and the crooner and the, now that is, he grew up surrounded by men who were like my granda and my great uncles, you know, the guys who were aspiring to be Nat King Cole or perhaps Frank Sinatra or whoever, you know, that he kind of grew up in that sort of melange of influences and music too. And so I asked him about that, and you know, that was something that he kind of connected to, and it was really lovely actually, because for me then, you know, a generation or so, two generations perhaps down, I grew up looking at Roxy Music and thinking, okay, well, what's my version
of this?
What can
we do?
You know,
yeah.
And so you kind of pass it on, don't you? Hopefully that's how it works.
I love the idea of the effort put in the whole, like a thing like the bin bags and ripping off when it's probably a pub gig. I always remember, in fact, around the corner here, really early on in Paloma Faith's career, I remember doing a gig with her, and she did her gig. And again, it's kind of in a pub essentially. Mm-hmm. And she had this paper dress that she gradually rip parts off of to change the style of dress and all that. And after that gig, I just remember watching thinking, I really hope you get massive, because this deserves to be this works in a stadium. In a pub it's 50-50. In a pub it might not work, but in a stadium this is the ultimate. This is art, this is beauty.
Obviously for Paloma, she kind of took it that we pretty much stayed playing the pub gigs, but we enjoyed it. It was fun.
So what was it like kind of starting off a band in that era? Obviously it wasn't only a London centric, the kind of indie scene that was building up. It was something that felt a bit more out in all the different areas and all the different locations.
Well, Britpop was,
it felt homegrown.
Britpop was very kind of London centric, but it's
sure.
funny, isn't it, because people look back at the 90s and they only sort of see that, and obviously, you know, I guess you do that with every decade, you have the kind of highlights reel. Actually the 90s was so much more diverse than you often see on TV or hear people talking about on radio or whatever. So we came from a northeast scene that was very DIY, you know, very kind of guitar heavy. I grew up going to see lots of kind of grunge bands, really. That was the first music that I kind of discovered that I felt like mine. Got really, really into that. And then I suppose I was thinking about this because I had a very young band in to see me who I really liked last week. And one of them was wearing an excellent hat. And I was like, oh my God, amazing hat. Tell me about the hat. And he's like, oh, I want to look like Jennifer Harima, who from Royal Trucks.
Right.
And I like love Royal Trucks. Yeah. Oh my God, I love Royal Trucks. And I went to see them when I was 15 and all this. And I was talking to him and I was thinking about going to see their band, and just kind of the way that I went to see them, and the drummer was chatting me up afterwards.
Right.
Like kind of, I was 15 or whatever and left. Yeah. And actually, as mentioned earlier, like my dad was literally outside in the car. Poor dad. Took us home, so that kind of never went anywhere. And then a few months later I went to see Free Kitten, Kim Gordon's band. And then I left that gig and the next day formed a band, because we had shouted out, they'd asked for,
amazing,
they were improvising songs, and they said let's you know, give us some phrases to improvise songs around, and I shouted cat suits, because I thought that was funny, and they were like, what? And did a song that had that in it, I think it had that word in it. And then the next day I went out and formed a band, and our first EP, Kinnicky's first EP, was called Katsu City.
Amazing.
Because of that. And I was thinking about this after talking to this guy out of the other band, how funny that is. And I hadn't thought about it since, and this is like 25 years later or whatever, that I'd left that first gig where I'd kind of been really, you know, enthusiastically talking to this guy and being like, oh my God, like, I love your music. And do you like this record? And what do you think about that? Yeah. And he was like, hey, do you want to see the van? And I left, like, I was pretty depressed by that experience, even though, you know, I absolutely love their music still and always will. And, you know, fair play. He just saw a pretty girl or whatever he thought. And fine. But I left that and I felt a bit kind of like, oh no, I was telling you all the things I love. And then, but when I left that other gig.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, I can do this.
Absolutely inspired. It's amazing finding them ones that give that moment of inspiration. And there it feels like that slight engagement
makes you go, not much.
I kind of helped write that song.
Oh, I didn't think.
I'm a co-writer on that song. I said the word first. It's weird. I always remember I saw two gigs in 1 week and they were the ones that made me think, I'm going to try this. And it's a weird mix because it was the Beastie Boys who are obviously legendary, and the Bloodhound Gang, who I absolutely adored. But both of them I kind of looked at and went, this is amazing, but equally, why not? Yeah. I'm not saying I could do it on that level, but definitely do something. I'm rapping along to every word of both of them. Therefore, you know, there's something there that can make me, that you could potentially do.
I think that's it. And I kind of, because it was really weird, because I was just talking about a hat and then started thinking about all this stuff. And I was saying, I wanted to go back to that guy and say to him, you know, you're in a band now who are really, really popular. Please remember, like, when you get to interact with people.
The power and impact of
it. Like, give, you know, say to them, say, like, you can do this.
Yeah, yeah.
Or try it, or like, leave a little space for them to join in, you know.
Don't, completely.
Yeah.
How, with, again, I want to kind of get to moving down to London and working your way into radio, but just speaking of radio now, you kind of, you've got that great power and opportunity to help push a lot of new music, to help inspire a lot of new bands. How exciting is that? Like, how excited, going to gigs as well, it's that weird thing. Generally, in most people's gig-going career, if they get into the industry as such, they'll have the bit where they love going to gigs, then the bit where they have to go to gigs and it's kind of a chore, and then hopefully come back round to that bit where it's like, this is amazing.
When I get to go now, it's such a treat because I've got two kids.
Obviously, so you've got the family.
Is like, you know, that's the bit that's really tricky for me. So any time that I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like, I'm going to do songs.
It was really weird. When I got my radio show on XFM, I'd had that period of touring for years. And it wasn't until I started doing the radio show that I realised I'd stepped away from music a lot that wasn't mine, because I was so focused on writing and touring and that. And when I suddenly had to have new music every week and new acts and new artists, it's the most informed I've been in years of music. Because, like, I knew everything that was going on in Southern California to Minneapolis to all this in the kind of alternative hip-hop scene. And that was a great thing to, as your job, to be really into music.
I mean, it is the best job I've ever done, without doubt. It is such a pleasure. There's a point every Friday where one of us on the team will kind of say, oh, we should do this tomorrow, and then realise we're not coming in. Oh, shit. You know,
disappointed. I'll do something else, I guess.
Oh, the weekend. So it's always a pleasure. And it's funny, isn't it, because I think, like, obviously, I try not to take myself too seriously. You know, you've got to know that if you are a jock, you are among your people. When people say, you know, Alan Partridge, like, all of you know your people, right? And don't think that because you're on an indie station, you know, you're any different. It's not. It's the same job.
Yeah.
And I feel very kind of, I feel really get quite emotional about radio, you know.
Yeah.
Today at Six Music, they just renamed our building Wogan House.
Oh, wow.
This morning,
beautiful.
And they kind of unveiled it was Western House and now it's become Wogan House. And
I love that,
you know, me too. And that I can kind of walk through those doors every day and there's, you know,
my biggest excitement anytime I was in for Six Music was it when I'd be waiting and Wogan had happened to walk past. And it would be just that aura, that excitement of
absolutely, oh yeah, gosh. Yeah, no, exactly. And you know, so many of those guys, that's one of the amazing things about being part of that, working in that building and being part of that industry, is they're just such incredible and really lovely people, like radio people, generally speaking. Obviously, you know, there's always one or two bad apples, but it's nerdy, right?
Yeah,
so that's like
completely.
The good, it kind of draws the good people to them. So for me, I feel like that is where I belong. But then I think in terms of, like, you know, playing people's records and like you say, giving people a platform and kind of choosing who you're going to give that to, I hear like really big responsibility, really brilliant. But you have to, while I don't take myself seriously, I take that seriously.
Yeah.
I take what we're doing really seriously.
Yeah.
And try to make it really good. And obviously, you know, every day I think we have such an amazing opportunity because I get to go to work and choose to make something beautiful every morning. So as far as I'm concerned, like, that's my job.
Yeah,
and then
there's, amazing.
You know, there's lots of other stuff around that, like people, you know, how you choose what to play. And there's a whole kind of industry, isn't there, of pluggers and things. And I try not to get into that. For me, I feel like it's my job to... It's not like it's an artwork or something, but it's more, it is like a mixtape, you know, for a friend every day. And how's it going to be? What does Tuesday feel like? How is Monday different from Thursday?
I love that.
And you and kind of follow people's week. And
I think you're great as well as of interacting with your listeners in that way of bringing them into it and knowing, because again, the fact is you are effectively there as their servant as such in that sense. So it has to, exactly. So it has to be an engaging relationship. It can't just be like, I don't know, it always used to annoy me in kind of early 2000s, I guess, when there was a bit of a trend of bands being very much, I'm going to perform my art. And if you enjoy it, you enjoy it. If you don't, you don't. And I've always come from the opposite of that of, damn, you've paid to get in. I'm being paid to be here. You've paid to be here. I need to make sure you're happy and not going over the top with it, but trying to keep that entertainment. So having an awareness of and that interaction with your listeners of what they want and what gets a good reaction, it's got to be a positive thing.
I mean, it's just they're so funny, you know, and so lovely and so interesting. So we make space for them every day on our program. That's really important. You know, there's a good kind of 20 minutes, half an hour every single day where it's a listener's choice or it's everybody's choice, you know, we do people's playlist each week.
And
so that's, you know, that's really important. But I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, you kind of say that I've always found, like, having interviewed a lot of people now over the years.
Yeah.
The thing that I think it strikes me is that the better people's ideas are, the stronger their ideas are, the keener they are to communicate them to you clearly.
There's a
lot of smoke and mirrors about people who aren't quite as good. There's not quite as much there as they'd like you to believe.
Yep,
you know, it's a bit of a kind of, you know, look around the eyes, don't look into the eyes.
Yeah.
It's a bit of that, isn't it? So
I
always find that when you really speak to people like, you know, Laurie Anderson, I never got to interview David Bowie, but hearing all of the archives that we played out of David Bowie's interviews, Anoni came in a few months ago and she's just amazing and so keen to really get across, this is my idea, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
That real kind of directness. Like, I love that.
Yeah.
You know?
And again, it's there's a beauty and purity in that. Years and years ago, I remember talking to Saul Williams and being surprised,
amazing,
hearing him say, he said to me, and not in an aggressive way, but I have no loyalty to the underground. My aim, I'm excited about what I'm doing. So the more people I can talk about it to, the more people I can get my message is a tough word because Saul can be put in that bracket of preachy or mainstream. But again, the more people that I can get my art across to, the better. And again, it's that beautiful thing. He's got that laser focus of, no, let's get this out to as many people as possible.
I mean, he came in right at the beginning of the year, February, I think he was in, and he's my standout session of this year.
Yeah.
Just absolutely amazing performer and obviously, you know, author and writing everything else that he does. I was like, what should I call you? And he went, just say I'm an artist. And I was like,
I lucked out on having him on the podcast because numerous times he was almost giving out a monologue and I'm sitting there thinking, damn, I'm not intelligent enough to respond to this. And just at the end of it, he'd say something that was relevant to something I'd like read that morning or something like that. So in the podcast, I looked almost
in
as intelligent as Saul.
But so many times I'm relating to that.
The phrase
I know
is going,
exactly how that feels.
This is amazing, but what can I say other than, that's amazing, man? You know, which isn't a very good interview, just letting someone speak, then saying, great, continue, keep going, this is great. So I lucked out on that episode. But what an amazing guy.
Really, really brilliant.
I guess as well, having had that experience in the music industry, you know, you truly know, and from talking to you here, appreciate how much it means to play people on the radio. And because, again, it was another thing, and not to keep referencing my brief a run on XFM, but I had a show at midnight on XFM and I didn't think too much. I was like, I'm going to play stuff that's cool. Mm. This is good. And then after the first couple of weeks, I'd have people message saying, that's my first ever airplay in the UK or first ever airplay anywhere. And suddenly I was like, I remember that's when John Kennedy played my first song.
Everybody
and it meant
remembers.
Everything. Yeah.
Everybody remembers yeah. the first time they heard themselves on the radio. Yeah. It is the one thing, whether you are, you know, the Stones or yeah. Art Brute yeah. or, you know, whoever, like whatever place in the spectrum you occupy, it's magical.
Yeah.
You know, and it is the moment that everybody remembers. And I remember, John Peel playing my record on my 18th birthday as my dad was driving us to a gig. God
Amazing.
Love him. And we were all crammed into the back of the car with like guitars poking out. One of the guitars was out the window, you know, because we couldn't fit everything into the back of the car. And I remember him playing our record and us screaming, and it was just unbelievable. And to get to give that to people is yeah. that is, it really yeah. is such a pleasure.
It's beautiful. I remember I missed the first time that we were played because John Kennedy, I love him dearly, but he so loves being on the ball that we didn't even know. We'd sent it off, didn't even know.
It had been and gone.
And we knew he was going to play it the next day, and I tuned in, and it was me. I still lived at my mum's. It was me, my mum, and my brother, and our mate Andy, listening through the TV for some reason. I don't know why we had it just listening through the TV.
Must have been then.
Yeah,
get a clearer
and
signal.
He was sitting there, and it was one of them things of going no, because he was saying, "Oh, I played this song yesterday, and it got such a big reaction." We're like, it probably isn't us. And then he just gave the longest. It's I swear it felt like half an hour of teasing. Like, well, it's definitely not going to be this one. And then it's the first beat started, it was like
it's like it would,
oh my god,
the opposite of the Zoolander moment.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
Did you tape it? Did you record it?
I think we recorded it on the TV, like because you could record radio on Sky Plus, and we've got it somewhere. But yeah, it meant the world. But so a Six Music is one of those exciting things of a now massive radio station that still has that much freedom. Obviously, there are playlists and things like that, but has that freedom to break stuff on shows throughout the day, not just on some show in the middle of the night, mm. kind of throughout. Do you think the best thing that happened to Six Music was the attempt to close down Six Music? Because it really seemed to be the whole Save Six Music movement seemed to just take it all to the next level and make people appreciate or what they had there.
It galvanised everything, didn't it?
Yeah.
I think it did. It had a lot of interesting effects. Some people will. There's a conspiracy theory that, you know, oh yeah, it's just this is the publicity campaign that somewhere dreamed up. Honestly, not. They were really, really going to close
yeah.
it. And it was really horrible and scary at first. But then the most incredible thing happened, and our listeners rallying around us. It did a few things. Obviously, it got the word out about the station, which yeah. was amazing. And then since then, we've kind of continued to grow, which was wonderful. It showed us, everybody who works there, it showed us what we meant to people in yeah. a way that, you know, we knew, but it's different. You know, when you are standing at a protest and there's like someone with the Father Ted down with this sort of thing
yeah.
sign and somebody else who's made cupcakes with records on top, you know.
Amazing.
And you actually are all together and you meet everybody and they come through for you. Like, you know, you know that what you do matters to them.
Yeah.
In a different way from before, in a more real way from before. And also, you know, you owe them, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The other thing that happened in the kind of strange knock-on, apart from all of that wonderful stuff, and then, you know, they saved us, like we all owe them every day to come in and do our best. And I think we actually raised our game across the board, not just people on air, because obviously there's a small amount of people who are on air, and then the bulk of the station is the people that you don't hear, but who make
course.
It all happen. And we all felt that, you know, we all just worked really, really hard, and we just care about what we do. We always cared about it, but now we felt like fully justified in, you know, like you say, like I do think, I think there's something a little bit magical about radio. It's something, it's like, and you know, I don't really differentiate between, you know, radio and podcast. To me, it's the same thing, that moment where you're in somebody's ear and you are with them in their day, whatever they're doing, whether they're walking to work, going home, you know, they might be up in the middle of the night feeding their baby.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking of the times that I listen, you
completely.
Know, and like, actually it's such an amazing kind of privilege.
Yeah.
And we saw that kind of play out in front of our eyes. So
yeah, exactly. And it's a beautiful thing. And I think at times the BBC have kind of had its hand forced a bit, but it's caused great progressions and Six Music with its online players, its podcasts and things like that. But then equally, I know there was some uproar on TV as the BBC Three channel was becoming digital only. And it was this scary thing. But I think a lot of these things are hugely positive because for BBC Three and for 4OD and things like that, because they've gone online, number one, that's the way the world's going with that's podcasts and everything. And number two, it gives that is. Much, it seems to have given more freedom. Both of them seem more comfortable. As I said, BBC Three and 4OD and all the digital services seem more comfortable going, oh, let's give this a try on more unusual stuff that they maybe wouldn't have if it was, well, we've got our primetime slot. Is it getting the audience? It's going, well, it's online. Let's take some risks. Let's push things out there.
It sort of brings everything into quite a clear focus, doesn't it? It's that very, you know, that vision of what we're about. Why are we here? What are we doing? For me, it's Six, I think. You know, we are lucky in that the wind's in our sails with the technology, so it's brilliant. You know, we just had another set of radar figures, which are, you know, over 2 million now, which is just incredible. And I remember years ago when our then boss said, I want to try and get the station to 2 million, you know, I think we can do it. And we were all like, well, that sounds brilliant, but also, what? I just thought that was insane, you know, and here we are, and it's amazing. And I think while we've brought all those new people in, we haven't lost the core of what we do. So that it's just really, really exciting to be part of it. But with the wind's in our sails with the technology, like you say, you know, we're digital, that's where everybody is. So 100%. While it's great to get those brilliant figures, you've got to remember that we are lucky that we don't have the problems that every other major radio station has.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting, isn't it, the way that it's reported, and it's a bit of a radio nerd thing, and I'm sure people won't be interested. But I think it's interesting that you have, you know, networks like Radio 4 and Radio 2, and they've got very big FM audiences that they need to migrate to digital.
Yeah.
And then you've got Radio 1 who kind of have the opposite problem where, you know, they'd love to be able to put together their Facebook likes and the YouTube views and everything else, and then kind of translate that into you know, a non-digital, some other kind of number that they can all put it all together. And then there we are in the middle. It's funny. We're small, but we're kind of like, we're not beset by any of those really difficult problems that everybody's sort of dealing with.
It's kind of the beauty of the position of Six Music, of not the lack of expectation, but of the kind of you're there and you kind of it feels like the channel that most of all in the BBC range is kind of left to do what you do. Like, it's like not meddled with too much, a Radio 1, there's huge pressure. It's Radio 1. It's always had this certain status and things like that. So if something starts to slightly not work, then are we going to change everyone? Are we going to change someone? Whereas it feels like Six Music, it's comfortable to go, well, you get on with what you're doing, and that allows it to flourish and turn into this beautiful resource.
We're very lucky, I think. And I feel like on my show, you know, I took over from George Lamb. You know, George Lamb's show was so different to my show.
It's
you know, a real kind of completely different thing, and it's changed a lot over the 9-10 years or whatever it is I've been there. And I think we've had loads and loads of support and kind of been allowed to get it to the point that it is now.
Yeah.
But it is, like you say, you've got to be allowed to try things, and you've got to be kind of left to go, look, I really think this will work. You know, like, you have an idea. We had the other day, we had September was quiet, and I just thought, oh, well, let's do a kind of back to school thing. We'll just get interesting people to come and talk to us, and they can be our teachers. So we had a maths lesson from Marcus de Sotoy, and John Savage came and gave us a music lesson. All this, it was brilliant.
Amazing.
Roger Highfield, who runs a science museum, came and gave us a science lesson.
Oh,
and
fantastic.
I'd met Chris Riddell, who's a political cartoonist, but also the children's laureate, an amazing illustrator and children's author.
Amazing.
I'd done a Q&A with him last year at the British Library about Alice in Wonderland, because Tenniel, who did the original Alice in Wonderland illustrations, was a political cartoonist illustrating a children's book, which is exactly kind of what he does. amazing guy. And we got talking, and he said, I draw to your show in the mornings. I do listen, and I'll come in, and one day he just draws all the time. He said, I'll come in, I'll draw the show. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, I can just, like, I'll do some sketches as you play records. So we did it, and we broadcast it on Facebook Live. And we had, Chris was literally with one hand holding his mobile and then with the other doing a sketch inspired by whatever record I was playing. So Transmission by Joy Division, you know, I kind of intro amazing, it, stick yeah. it on. He do, and during the record, he does these incredible illustrations. And it's the kind of thing where, like if you'd written that down, you would go, how is drawing on the radio, like, actually going to work? That completely. Just sounds really weird.
If you'd had a pitching meeting.
A focus said, group,
here's,
you know
here's
what
our plan. It'd be like... Right. Okay. On to the let's move. Let's move on from
there. No way. If you'd had to kind of apply for, you know, funding or whatever. But honestly, it was magic, yeah. And we had so many people listening and getting in touch about it. We've kept the illustrations. We are going to hopefully we're going to auction them for Children in Need this month. But it was just really, really special. So they give you the freedom definitely to try things. And yeah. We really appreciate that.
I love it. So it's hard to know where I want to. I go next. I'm going to go back to where I actually intended to start because I want to talk to you about the pool because I think again it illustrates the huge variation of things you've done over the years from writing to presenting and everything else, and it feels kind of. I mean, you started it. Oh, when did it start? It was a couple of years ago,
18
right?
months ago. Yeah, 18 months I mean, ago. We started planning a long time before that. It was quite a long process to, you know, get the site built and to develop the idea and then, you know, make it happen. Yeah. But we've been live for about 18
it's,
months.
And it's one of those things that has become almost, feels unfortunately important at the moment, just with, obviously, everything that's gone on in the US, and I'm not going to get political because I've had two podcasts in a row where we're banging on about all that, but a president elected who was kind of openly a misogynistic and sexist in the lead up to the election. So explain what the pool is. It's a website for women and kind of made by women as well.
At the minute, yeah, all female team at the minute. We did
but it's,
have
again,
we
it's,
had
it's
one
a multimedia
guy,
type thing as well as the guy left. That one
Charlie,
guy.
Charlie.
Was he employed to tick boxes? Was it? was
no,
he the mandatory male?
He the best people for the job. And he was great. But no, he moved on. But yeah, it's all female team at the minute, which is amazing. And, you know, not something that, like I say, is deliberate. It's just sort of the way it's worked out. But so we are a website, we not exclusively for women, but made by women and kind of with women in mind. And we cover everything from news, opinion, politics, to art and culture, fashion, beauty, you know, everything that you would maybe be interested in the course of your day and expect to read in your favourite magazine. But it's multi-platform, so it's written pieces, it's video content and podcasts and audio as well. So we do music as well too.
That's it. What I kind of love there is it's not for women in a women's mag kind of way. It's for everyone, as you said. It's news, it's music. But man, that's important to have a female perspective on a lot of these things, because it isn't so often throughout media. It isn't, or the default is male. The default is male, and it's so much written from a male perspective. So, I think it's great to have that kind of angle.
I mean, part of the reason that I wanted to start doing this site, like, as you know, and started thinking about the original idea for the site, which was smaller, and it, you know, grew very fast. Sam Baker, who's my co-founder, was my editor when I was writing a column for her at Red Magazine, and she moved on from that job, and I met up with her for a cup of coffee, and I started thinking, I'd been thinking about doing something digital for a while, but at that point, this is a few years ago, wasn't quite sure what it was going to be. Would it be like a blog? Could it do like a mail out? You know, how would it work? And we started developing this idea, and part of the reason that I wanted to do it was that I was looking around at media and I was kind of thinking, like, where are all the people who are all the girls younger than me?
Yeah.
I mean, there are a couple, there are some, you know, there's like Alice Levine's brilliant, and, you know, Gemma Kearney's a good mate of mine. And But, like, there aren't, you know, when it's I was coming up, lot. I was like one of loads.
Yeah.
You know, and we all kind of sort of came on together and we got loads of encouragement from, I remember that getting my first job in radio, which was taken over from Zoe Ball on XFM, as the aforementioned, and getting home to my crappy flat. And there was a massive bunch of flowers on my doorstep from Zoe to say, congratulations.
You Amazing.
Know, we all kind of like encouraged each other. And I'd been quite looking forward to that bit. You know, I was thinking like, where are they?
Yeah.
And then it struck me that...
I want to say congratulations to someone.
Like, hey, where is everyone? You know, it's like being a DJ and you finally get on the decks and you realise the dance floor's empty.
Yeah.
And so looking around, I realised actually working in the music industry, I thought, oh, the same thing has happened to media. So all of the kind of, you know, satellite TV shows. There was this proliferation of satellite TV shows in the 90s, obviously, as I'm sure you remember.
Yeah.
And that was where I learned how to present to a point. I'm sure some people would be like, you never got that good, Lauren. Don't wind your neck in. Don't do it yourself up. But, you know, that was, you cut your teeth and you did silly things and kind of learned the job. And I suddenly realised that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And that's kind of gone. And so you have YouTubers, many of whom are completely fantastic, but who are doing a slightly different job. They're not, you know, not quite kind of doing what I do. And there's a gap.
Yeah.
So I sort of thought, right, well, if we create something where we can, you know, help women, young girls and young women get their voices out there, you know, we champion them and help them kind of try things, that kind of element of experimentation
and
is really important to me.
That experience.
Get, you know, this can be a place that people cut their teeth. And so for me, that was a really important part of wanting to do the site. And then also as from a consumer perspective, I just felt like there was so much online. The atmosphere was kind of hectic and judgmental and there was too much of it. And I wanted to come to a place that felt like informative and smart and interesting, but kind of quite relaxing and aspirational at the same time and wasn't kind of too full on, you know, this kind of overwhelming online atmosphere. So the idea of the pool is that it's kind of clear and refreshing.
Yeah.
But it's also like a nice place to be and a nice place to hang out. So we kind of, you know, put all that into a blender and then that's where the website came from. And it's grown a lot over the, you know, the last couple of years. The team is now, I think it's about, depending on the day, because not everybody's full time, can be about like 23, 24 people
that's amazing.
In the office. And they're coming through now, incredible writers and you know, girls making AV content for us, and Marissa Bates and Lynn Enright, Caroline O'Donoghue, all having huge hit pieces and are, you know, they're part of our team, they're part of our core team, they're every day making the site. It's amazing.
I love that. And it's key because there's so many different areas and disciplines that people don't kind of give enough credit to or realize it's something that has to be learned and things like that, and presenting is a key one of them. Again, I think cutting your teeth on satellite shows and things like that has then allowed you to be able to comfortably present anything from festival coverage to the culture show and stuff like that, and a real variation. And I don't know, it's a weird one because people tend to assume that if you've been on TV, then you can also present and you can also do this. And it's such a mixed area. I think 10 o'clock live was a great example of that because I think it got a bit misunderstood in many ways. I personally enjoyed it, but also was aware that everyone has their roles. You're not necessarily there to be a comedian. The comedians aren't necessarily there to present, but you need all of these things to hold it all together. It's not a comparison, but I did a tiny mixed martial arts show on BT Sports at one point, and I was on there as an expert, and this fighter was on there as an expert, and then OJ Borge was on there as the host, and he got a lot of flack for potentially not knowing as much as some of the other guys, but he was doing the bit where you have an earpiece and have to lead things along and have to
try and
talk the conversation, but be having someone in your ear going, we need to cut this, we need to move on here. And that's, I always got so defensive of OJ because it's like, I can't do that. I tried that. I did that once and I found it horrible because there's a really interesting conversation and someone's in my ear going, right, wrap this up and move on to this.
Yeah, shut him up. Yeah.
I wanted to look at the camera and argue with the producer that no one else can hear, because it's like, I want to hear this conversation. Just stop it. So
yeah,
it is. It's a balance of those skills that people don't necessarily appreciate as just a viewer.
It's a funny job, isn't it? Because if you are a good host, then essentially your job, if you're very good at it, then people don't know you're doing it.
Yeah,
I mean that's the best. Yeah, you know, Wogan is a really good example of that.
Of course.
I remember years and years ago, one of the first TV jobs I did, I was working with Johnny Vaughan, and Johnny talking about kind of hosting and presenting, and I always kind of describe myself as a host rather than a presenter, because it is a bit like having a party in a way.
Yeah.
And it can be a serious party, you know, it can be a roundtable discussion on Radio 4 or whatever, but you've got some people coming around to your house for dinner, like you don't, and you've had a fight with your husband and the dinner is burnt and there's smoke coming out of the oven, like you shut the door on the kitchen, right? And you don't fight in front of people. So obviously the better a host you are, the more you kind of hide your workings to an extent, and you know, you can't say like, well, I'm just doing my job, and that, you know, like shutting people up, as you say, or you're on the red carpet and you have to do a hot change, industry term, which is where, you know, you're talking to one star and then another comes up behind them and you've got to kind of really politely like get rid of the first person,
just go by this,
start
someone
talking to them, it'd be like, hot change, Kate Winslet's on your left. And it's such a weird kind of funny job.
The skill of politely wrapping things up is
Have a great night is the key. It is a totally bizarre job to do. I love it. It's so much fun and so interesting. But, you know, like I say, where do you learn to do that now?
Have you been able to translate that skill into when you're walking around London in a rush and you bump into someone that was like on the show once or something and they're like, and have that hot change of being able to
good to see you.
I'm moving on now. just really polite, quick.
I am good at small talk. I will go, but the thing I've never learned to do small talk about is travel.
Right.
So when, you know, my nightmare is being at a dinner party and with someone who will tell you the route that they got to get where you are. Like that's my, that for some reason that just makes me feel like I'm going to have some kind of hemorrhage when I'm listening to someone.
It's a funny one, because every time if I've driven somewhere, every time anyone asks me what way I came, it's literally, followed the arrow on the screen now because of sat navs. It's literally, you could tell me any road and I would agree that's what I drove
along.
I was like, I wasn't.
Oh, the I-303 was a nightmare. Yeah, like, if I'm with that guy, I might burst into tears. But apart from that, I'm good at small talk.
I had Limmy on the podcast and I had a tweet about it the other day, and someone was saying, I'm amazed that I've just sat through over 20 minutes of Limmy talking about a train journey and it was thoroughly enthralling and entertaining throughout. And he's one of the unique people I could listen to that conversation
with. If anyone could, it would be him.
He can pull that off. So I'll start to wrap things up as we're getting towards the hour mark. But one of the things I wanted to discuss was, what was the kind of transition from the band into radio? It was radio you went to first, or was it TV first? What was the kind of...
It was TV first. I did Dep for Steve Lamacq on the evening session when I was 19. What? Wow. How did that happen?
Yeah.
I remember sitting in the chair looking at his desk, and he'd unwisely gone on holiday, and knowing that I was going to introduce a Mogwai record and then play In the Navy by the Village People.
Amazing.
For 2 seconds before putting it back to Mogwai.
Yeah.
And just this feeling of like absolute terror. And also, I could run mad with the pet. This is amazing. This is fantastic.
Yeah.
So technically, I did Radio 4.
That's amazing. At 19, at Radio 1,
there was nobody telling me what to do. It was so weird.
I always remember having a talking to Hugh Stevens. And again, in general, you talk about radio careers. Like, I started off on this and then everyone went to XFM at some point.
Yeah.
And then got here. And Hugh's like, at 16, I started on Radio 1. It's like, right, so you just started, as a child, you just started at the top of like, the biggest station.
All right,
station.
Tom Daly, like, calm down. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, yeah,
I was on the high diving board, not a big deal. Can show you some stuff. So I did do that. Dep for Steve first, absolutely loved it. But then, just because of kind of what was going on, I'd been offered some TV jobs while I was still in the band. So I started doing kind of music shows, like I say, satellite TV and someone on Channel 4 and Channel 5. I did a show called Pop on Channel 5 and did loads of that kind of stuff. And I just sort of did it for show money, really.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, this is, do this for a bit. It's fun.
Yeah.
And it just kind of never stopped. And then I was offered a show on XFM, and that was the Saturday show. And that was, it was really, really like coming home, and it was just what I loved. And and for me, that was when I kind of found my little, I found my nook, you know.
I love the things, I like that. And I swear most people you talk to can't sit down and say, here was the plan, or there was this plan thing. It's like, I agreed to that because it sounded fun. Mm-hmm. And then on that, I met this person and that sounded fun. It's like stumble from one thing to another. And at the end, you get to look back and go, well, that looks like I knew what I was doing, didn't it?
It's post-rationalisation, isn't it? All that, the best you can do is kind of like, I am going to form a coherent narrative out of this later. For now, you know, you kind of, you try stuff. And also it's, I've been lucky enough to follow what I think is interesting, what I find interesting.
Yeah.
And I think if you get to do that, you have won the pools. So I've always just felt very, very lucky. And as long as I have that ability, like, to me, that is just, that's what success is. Do you know what I mean? To do a job that's interesting. Like, my dad always said, you know, but he was the kind of classic working class grammar school boy in the 60s who went going to university and becoming an academic. And he said, if you do something that you're interested in, you'll never work a day in your life.
Yeah.
And
completely.
That's absolutely true.
And I legitimately think finding ways to justify your obsessions as such. And again, it's great that you get to regularly cover music and movies and art,
like,
and all sorts of different things.
I've done the same thing since I was 15. You know, it's like records, clothes, you know, mates, books. That's it.
This is there what I like covering.
As far as I'm concerned, your family, there isn't anything else. You know?
Yeah. I love that. So what's ahead? Or before I get onto what's ahead, what are you enjoying at the moment? Because we did talk about potentially just chatting about stuff. Are there any films, any music, anything? Like, what's exciting you the most at the moment?
There's so much. I think what's really interesting about music at the moment is there seems to me to be this kind of nascent, it's not nascent in some places, right out the front, but I remember a few years ago being at Glastonbury Festival and trying to find an angry band. And you just kind of couldn't, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody was, the vibe was just so mellow. You know, everyone had kind of melodicas and banjos and things, and it was just really chill. It was really nice, and loads of the music was great. But there was nothing kind of angry. And I was thinking, oh, this is, you know, this is funny. And I think one of the very interesting things about the situation, you know, sort of political and cultural situation going on in 2016, is that as you have the kind of mainstream cohering into a particular kind of, you know, political direction, I think there's a counterpoint to that going on in alternative culture.
Yeah.
And at the minute, I'm really interested in that and really watching, you know, what's coming out of that. You have a band like Sleaford Mods probably leading the charge, I think, fair to say.
Completely.
You know, two guys from an estate in Nottingham making their version of grime.
Yeah,
which is just like, what?
Yeah.
And it's, as I was, they were in on the show the other day, and I said, the thing I love about them is they're just different to everybody else, but they're different to everybody else in about 8 different ways.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like
nobody else
like that. So they were the first kind of really bringing this kind of confrontational sound out there, and it's amazing. And obviously, you know, there's always been elements of it in genres like punk, like grime, like that's ever present. But kind of, you know, a new development that feels new, and I think there's as you have the mainstream kind of cohering, I think there's something similar happening in kind of underground and alternative culture.
Yeah, and it's kind of
very exciting.
It's fascinating to watch. It's fascinating to watch how it bleeds into all different things as well. So there's certain bands that have always going to have that political edge or that angry edge or things like that, but there's a guy called Rob Alton who I've just put his spoken word, a record out of his on my label. And the reason I fell in love with his stuff is he's kind of spoken word. He's kind of a comedian. He does Edinburgh Fringe every year. And the thing that I fell in love with the first show of his I saw was, it was just called The Sky Show. And it was about how great the sky is. And it was the most uncynical, just genuinely like, it's brilliant, isn't it? Just an hour of how brilliant the sky is.
Laurie Anderson says, I come from a big sky place.
Yeah.
Amazing.
The year before that, he'd done the Yellow Show about how much he loves the colour yellow and things like that. And the one we did a video for on this is off this album, is A Letter from Father Christmas. And again, it's all positive, but then there'll be one line here or there that is just referencing the state of humans in general or the state of the world. And it seems to make it hit home all the more. It'd be such a throwaway little line that you'll be like, oh man, this is affecting everything. Even the safe, happy place has an element of, look, there's some bad stuff going on.
Well, because the safe, happy place becomes more important. Yeah. You know, why do we love fairy tales? And why do we because we're told them at night when it's cozy and we're safe. And why do we feel cozy and safe? We only really feel cozy and safe because it's dark and scary outside.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. There's such a kind of parallel with music, I think. Even the beautiful, twinkly, gentle stuff becomes so much more important because it becomes a refuge from other things that are happening.
Yeah, completely.
And, you know, I had another musician on my show last Friday who's an American singer-songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, actually started out playing the fiddle in kind of Appalachian American country music. Incredible player. And she said that, you know, looking at what's going on in the States, she just said her music isn't overtly political, but it is now. She said, I woke up and I thought, it's more, what I do is more important than it was yesterday.
Yeah, you know? Completely.
And I think that's absolutely right. So from my perspective personally, I think it's one of the great pleasures of doing music radio, and, you know, the same goes for the website, actually, is that you get to be the other place. You know, even if you're not, you know, we are politically neutral, you know, a BBC station, and we're not talking about politics, but we're somewhere where people can kind of step away from news and step away from the, you know, the rest of the world and kind of what's happening.
Yeah.
It's also where they can weirdly kind of engage with it as well and see other people's takes on it and other people's ideas. But it kind of becomes very important in opposition to what else is happening.
It can always become that strange safe and happy place and never more apparent than in this last year with some of the musicians we've lost. Because it's incredibly sad when Prince passed or when Bowie passed, but man, is it beautiful to tune in to a radio station and hear stories about that artist, and everyone's celebrating it. It's a weird thing. I discussed this with, I think as with Colin Murray, I was saying, obviously death is a sad thing, but it is also inevitable, and it's the only certainty in life, really. But humans' reaction to death can be the most beautiful thing there is. When people are pouring into the streets and singing Prince songs, I'm welling up thinking about it. Genuinely, just the occasional video is like, at that point, particularly Prince, who's my favourite artist, and I was like, man, I don't know how I feel about this, because again, I've still got the music. Uh-huh. I've still got, you know, my relationship with Prince isn't going to change. Mm. It's not like we were texting every other day. It's kind of, we've still got that. But then to go online and see everyone's stories and everyone's outpourings, everyone's our reactions, it can be a beautiful thing. And
well, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, like, we've unfortunately had so much of that this year, I think there's a few things. There's an amazing Bukowski poem called "It's Strange When Famous People Die." Have you
read
that one? So he wrote that in 1977, about 9 weeks after Elvis died, I think. And you look at the year 1977, if you think 2016 was bad, check out 77, because, you know, that was Chaplin, Garbo, Elvis, obviously, but also Maria Callas, you know, the early kind of, the very first big Hollywood stars and the very beginning of celebrity, I suppose, in the modern kind of mass media way that we think of it now. And he says in that poem that it's like, if you were walking down a street in a building that you've gone past every day is just not there anymore.
Yeah.
It's not that you knew that person or you maybe went into the building, but it's that slightly disorientating feeling that how can Bowie not be alive anymore?
Yeah.
And I do feel like as a music lover myself, if you love someone's perspective on the world so much, if their lens that they look through, the way they see things has become yours and they die, it is a loss.
Yeah,
it is a loss because you've internalized their vision of the world, the way they see the world.
Yeah.
And that's part of you. It's part of your identity.
Yeah, you've taken
what
that in and absorbed that.
What could be more personal than that? What could be more important and more and sadder, you know, to lose someone? But so I think it is a loss. It's really valid to feel sad and to feel that loss. But what has been strangely lovely, even though the days themselves were sad, you know, when, say, Bowie and Prince, obviously, but also Leonard Cohen. For me, you know, we've had so many other artists. Alan Toussaint, an incredible songwriter, producer, New Orleans legend. lots and lots of these artists dying this year, we get to go in and actually do something constructive on the day. And that's that really is the kind of other place thing that I'm talking about, you know, best exemplified by Bowie Day or Prince Day.
Yeah.
We go in and it's like, we need to be here for people. And it's like
the beauty of that. Everything else could,
you get to do something constructive.
Can go out the window and you can go, right, this is.
Yeah. So it's
we
kind
are
of
that safe haven.
Sad, but really, really beautiful as well. And people talking about what their music meant to them and just telling stories. And oh, it's amazing.
I love it. I'll start to wrap things up. I think I've said that three times now. So I will.
You're going to have to start at some point.
I'm going to ask two more things. I'm going to ask what's ahead, and that's where we'll end things. But before that, how important has Glastonbury been to your life? Because it occurred to me that as a band, Glastonbury is generally seen as the goal. In radio and TV, you've covered Glastonbury. In your first novel, Candy Pop, you wrote about a journey to Glastonbury.
Yeah, dude, yeah.
So it's
it's the Christmas of music.
It really is.
It's the Christmas of music.
I remember when I was going as a teen, it was this kind of this heavenly, unimaginable place. Because again, particularly at that point, there wasn't three festivals every weekend over the summer. There was it was this mecca of music and freedom and entertainment and everything.
Well,
so
it's it's such a special place to me, and I have a very kind of deep relationship with it now. Because Emily, Evis and Nick, her husband, are mates of mine. We were there, went down to the farm a few months ago to visit them.
Awesome.
And, you know, our kids play together and know each other, and they, you know, it's part of their lives as well. So for me, it's immensely important. You know, the first time I went, I was 17 or something, and the stage sank, and it was really, really and we didn't get to play, and we cut our clothes off and travelled home wrapped in bin bags because we didn't have anything. You know, it was just like total disaster.
Amazing.
But then going back and back, and it was the first big presenting gig that I got working with John Peel. And I think for me, it actually comes back to what we were saying earlier about that. You know, that person who just, if you're in a position to give someone permission to do something that they want to do, do it.
Yeah.
You know, if it's a good thing and it's not going to hurt them, do it. Because he did that for me.
Yeah.
We were sitting together on, I had no idea what I was doing. God knows why the book does. I've got no, you know, like, I look back now and I just look like a naughty boy. My friend Sophie said, you look like a naughty boy. You shouldn't be there. That's exactly me. I'm there in a Diamante choker and a parka, just like,
brilliant,
you know, giggling. And we were sitting around and John Peely went, you're made for this shit, aren't you? Like that in one of the breaks. And I just thought, oh, well, if John says I must be, you know, I'll do this then, kind of thing. It was a bit like that.
I love it.
And I doubt that he saw anything in us, you know what I mean? Like, I love John, but I doubt it. But it's that thing of somebody that you respect says to you, I think you can probably give this a go.
Yeah.
And you just can't. And so you believe them. And so, yeah, it's just,
it's
a powerful lesson in that,
makes
really.
You go, all right.
But then over the years, I mean, working there, you know, obviously interviewing everybody from, oh, God, you know, Metallica to Beyonce to Dolly Parton to Kate Tempest, to all of these incredible artists and, you know, up and coming bands, well, musicians every year. And then now we do a show, we try and do a show on radio every year where we get out with a mic and a backpack and just go out
amazing.
And just meet people. And then you meet, like, a lady called Glennie who's been working in the greenfield since the 60s and, you know,
that's
knew
awesome.
Everybody told us the stories from, you know, the very beginning and what the festival meant to her in her life, and said, I'm trying to compile an audio archive, you know, because my generation, we won't be around that much longer. This heartbreaking kind of conversation. Right the way through to, you know, the guy who built the first pyramid stage.
Oh, wow.
Decommissioned telegraph poles from the Ministry of Defence, which
amazing.
They thought was quite the lol back in the day.
Yeah, I bet they did. I bet they loved that.
And he was telling us all about
amazing.
That. So, you know, that's like the real stuff. And it's, other festivals don't have that. You know, they don't have the absolute integrity that Glastonbury does. It's, and one of the things that annoys me when people write about Glastonbury and they talk about, oh, you know, the kind of ultra luxe Glastonbury experiences.
Yeah.
Those are other companies that are nothing to do with Glastonbury Festival. People never clarify that. And it really frustrates me because there's, you know, obviously peripheral kind of land around Worthy Farm.
Yeah.
But those businesses aren't, they're not the festival, you know.
Right, yeah.
So I kind of think it just as I'm here, I might just point that out. Saw an article this morning in The Guardian saying, oh, when you see these deluxe festival Glastonbury packages, that wasn't what it was about. And so, maybe those still don't exist. You know?
It still isn't. I love that. I remember being such a snob for Glastonbury back in the day because a V festival was near me and I went to that one year and I was like, that's not a festival, man. And then I was like, it's not a festival. And I have to admit, the first, I think, two or three times I went to Glastonbury, we drove up there and bunked in over the fence because we couldn't afford tickets, but camped and had the most beautiful time. And it was all this wonderful, inclusive thing. And then, you did go to a V or even a Redden and Leeds initially. I was like, this is still cool, but it doesn't.
I've had some
like
brilliant times at other festivals, but it is just different. It's like Christmas, isn't it? You can have other parties, they're not Christmas. They can be excellent parties, but it is that.
I remember years and years later, the first time we played Bestival, it was the first place I got that same atmosphere and feeling. It was a smaller version, but it was the first time I was like, this is a festival, isn't it? This is what a festival's like. I get it now. I remember.
And it's something about the spirit of it. I mean, I don't want to sound like an old hippie, but it's who's behind it and where it's coming from, you know, the intention. And, you know, knowing as well, Rob the Bank is just and Josie, you know, they're coming from the same kind of place. You know, they absolutely love
the
music.
They're silly hippies. It's why it falls apart at points. And I think the first 3 years I played Best of All, I didn't play in the place I was originally booked to play.
That's the
beauty of it. It's like, oh, it's fine. Because it's, again, that is it. It's their spirit. They're not some big business or company that have gone, let's make some money off festivals, this. It means there will be some. I remember Eddie Temple Morris getting particularly angry about it at one point. And,
I can't imagine Eddie getting angry.
Yeah, it's because he'd got moved at some point, and he said
the most cheerful anger of all time.
Yeah, again,
still smiling, but
a positive anger.
Livid.
But I had to comment on his blog to say how much I love Best of All because me and Eddie were good mates. And he went, I've spoken to a close friend who's on Sunday Best, and he agrees that this isn't. And it happened to not be me, but I was like, that totally is going to seem to Robbie and everyone that it's me. So I was like, I understand your pain, but best of all, kind of all that, just to kind of go, look, I don't want to give it a bad image.
You're a lover, not a,
exactly.
Not a
hater. Well, thank you very much for coming in and chatting. I am actually going to wrap it up now. I want to ask what's ahead, but from our whole discussion, it seemed like it's never been that planned anyway, so I'm not sure if you'll know what's ahead, will
you?
Who
knows, Scroob? I mean, more records, more books, more, you know, thoughts and adventures. I think definitely, you know, working on Six Music and The Pool at the moment.
Yeah.
I've just not long been at Radio 4, kind of getting my feet under the table there, working at...
You've done all of them there, right? You've done 1, 2, 3, 4, 5
and
6.
Yeah, no, I've got the full gamut.
Did you get a badge or anything or a...
Medal? Do you know
they
what?
Should
I haven't even validated me pass to get us into the bloody, you know, broadcasting house.
You've got to sign in every day.
Not that I'm bothered. Now that they've renamed my building Wogan House, that'll do me. I don't want to go anywhere else. Why would you?
No.
But yeah, I should get some sort of, like, girl guide badge that I can sew onto my jumper.
Has the kind of motivations on what jobs you take changed at all since having a family, because I know you do a kids show as well and stuff like that, and is that kind of?
I'm doing more of those at T and Mo on CBeebies. If you've got kids, check it out. It's fun, so much fun. And I was singing for the first time in 20 years.
Amazing.
So, the CBeebies lullaby, the T and Mo song, "Go to Sleep." I got to sing. For the first time in two decades.
And that's got to be an exciting thing.
Brilliant.
Just from the perspective of exciting your children.
I had an album out on iTunes. iTunes did not exist last time I had a record.
That's mental, isn't it? Damn, that's scary. And it probably won't exist in however long as well.
Who knows what's ahead?
Constant movement. Well, thank you very much for coming in and chatting. Where can people keep up to date with you on social media and stuff and The Pool and whatnot?
Yeah, I'm at Lauren Laverne on Twitter and on Facebook as well. And The Pool is just thepool.com.
I also do recommend giving the Richard Herring Live at the Leicester Square Theatre podcast a listen as well, because it's a great listen. But thank you very much for coming in and chatting.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Scroobish Picks. distressed and peaceful.
There we go. That was Lauren Laverne. Isn't she just the loveliest in the world? I thoroughly enjoyed that. I thought it was great fun. Thank you for tuning in. I'll mention now, we put a new video up for a guy called Rob Alton, who's fantastic, a new signing to Speech Development Records, and I think you'll like it. If you go to my Facebook or Rob Alton's Facebook or even to YouTube, it's called A Letter from Father Christmas, and it's absolutely amazing. It's a 9-minute spoken word piece, which will put a lot of people off, which is why we're all the more delighted that in the first 24 hours it got over 12,000 views for a 9-minute spoken word piece. So thank you everyone for watching that. If you haven't watched it already, genuinely go and give it a look. I think give it 2 or 3 minutes, and if you don't stick around till the end, then fair play, but I think you will, and I think you'll be sharing it with all your loved ones. It's a beautiful piece. Anyway, I'll be back next week with Robert Sheehan from Misfits and numerous other things. A wonderful chat. He was one of the most open and honest and funny guys I've had on. So you're going to enjoy that one. Thank you for tuning in. I'll see you next week. Bye.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.